Welcome to another edition of Sea Control, your moment of PowerPoint rehab from the Center for International Maritime Security. As always, I am your host, Director of Online Content for SIMSEC, Matthew Hipple. This week's topic, China. Too often we discuss China as an obstacle, rather than a dynamic policy-making body with perspectives of its own that is reacting to the strategies of not just the U.S., but China's many neighbors. We have Dean Chang in with us for a conversation on China and the Chinese perspective on world events. We discuss China's desired end state, China's use of crises as a policy tool, as well as China's perspectives on her neighbors, the South China Sea, offshore control, air-sea battle, India, and escalation. Like a flourless brownie, this podcast is both dense and delicious. Stick around and learn something right after this short break.
Hola nuestros amigos. Do you like Sea Control? Do you enjoy the SimSec Next World blog? Become part of the discussion and our community. Sign up for SimSec membership at www.simsec.org/about/membership to get our articles and podcasts emailed to you every week, and an account that allows you to submit articles directly to our editors through WordPress. We think Sea Control is a very fine product, but it's nothing without your constant support and engagement. Your ideas keep us going. Now sit back and enjoy the show.
And we are back with Dean Chang. Now, Dean, as we do with every guest, instead of me reading a bio and telling everybody where you come from, I'll give you the opportunity to give the important beats, what your perspective is and where you're coming from, so the audience has a better understanding from your own mouth of who you are.
Okay. Well, my name is Dean Chang. I'm the Senior Research Fellow for Chinese Political and Security Affairs at the Heritage Foundation. I've been there for about 5 years. My focus is on mostly Chinese military developments, but also political. Economics isn't my beat, but I share a wall with our China economist, whose voice is often quite piercing. Before I came to Heritage, I was with the Center for Naval Analysis for about 8 years, and with SAIC before that, which I guess just proves that I can't hold a job.
Well, if anyone's wondering what that ominous sound is, it is thunder in the background, so no amount of audio manipulation on my part is going to get rid of that. So, Dean, we're talking about China, mainly because I went out to the Current Strategy Forum last week, and one of the things that some folks talked about is they wanted more China, as if we don't talk about China enough all the time, everywhere. But here we are, and I thought that it would be a good time to key it up with you. Now, one of the speakers, Lawrence Friedman, he made a good point. He said, we shouldn't talk about centers of gravity. We should talk about people's end states. Where do they want to go? So what is China's end game? What are they looking for? Are we going to see Pax Americana replaced with, I don't know, we'll call it Rex Sinica? What is it that they are looking for?
Well, part of the problem here is, to be honest, I'm not sure we know, and in some ways they may not know exactly what their end state is desired to be. But I think one of the key things to recognize is that China in many ways sees itself as a status quo power. Now, the problem here is that they define their status quo very differently than how we define our status quo. The American status quo in Asia pretty much spans the last 200 years or so. No surprise, we're only about 250 years old ourselves. And unfortunately, that period overlaps with China's most weak period through thousands of years of history. This is the period of the so-called century of humiliation. It's when China lost control of its destiny and its sovereignty. For China, its status quo is 3,500 years, 5,000 years, somewhere in that range, during which time China was always the center of Asia. You know, China in Chinese is Zhongguo, which is often translated as Middle Kingdom, but it can also be Central Kingdom, as in center of Asia. And so Xi Jinping, the current leader, actually has talked about a Chinese revival. That's the so-called China dream. So I think that if we were to start drawing boundaries and stuff, I think that this government's ideal boundaries, and in fact, they've just released a new map, so this is perfect timing here.
the long map, yeah.
The long map would basically encompass the Senkakus, Taiwan, the entire South China Sea, literally within, say, 12 miles of the Philippine, Malaysian, and Vietnamese coasts. It would have Arunachal Pradesh, which the Chinese call South Tibet. And there would then be this extended sphere of influence that would probably extend maybe as far east as Guam, but certainly into the Central Pacific, probably all the way down to the Coral Sea, and probably encompass most of the small countries between India and China. And then there's the interesting question about Central Asia, but that's more of Mr. Putin's problem than ours.
So what does this mean for their neighbors? Because that's a really broad stroke. That's a really big map. What's this going to look like? So we've seen the salami slicing in the South China Sea, and that strategy makes sense. For anyone who doesn't know what the salami slicing is, we're talking about sort of a passive-aggressive movement to set norms, to exist right underneath the lines of where a war might start and just kind of push their power forward. But a lot of this map, like you're talking about, involves pieces of other countries. Where do you think that this is going to go? Is this just aspirational and they know they won't get all of it? Or is it just we're going to beat this drum as hard as we can for as long as we can, and eventually we're going to see conflicts start exploding in Asia?
Well, the first thing to keep in mind is the Chinese aren't looking for a war or a fight. This is not Imperial Germany. Xi Jinping doesn't say, you know, China needs a war. Nobody's talking about a place in the sun. The second part to this is that a lot of these are maritime territories. So with the exception of India, you really don't have too many land borders at this point that are in dispute. Clearly, these islands are in dispute and they are claimed by a variety of players. But another piece of this is that most of these islands aren't inhabited. And in some cases, they barely exist. In fact, the Chinese have been dumping tons and tons of sand all over the place in order to try and create islands. The Chinese, I think, if you look throughout most of their history, have relied on intimidating, which interestingly in Chinese is the same word as deterring.
Interesting.
Their neighbors into becoming what's sometimes termed tributary states, right? Send us bolts of silk, fine horses, your most beautiful princesses, gold ingots. We'll marry off the princesses to our princes. We will, you know, assimilate essentially your technological and biological distinctiveness. But we're going to leave you alone. There weren't Chinese occupation troops in Manila or in Tokyo or whatever major cities existed in the Malay Peninsula back in, say, 800 AD. You take the tribute, you in return sort of establish a dominant subordinate relationship, and that's pretty much about it. So in this case, I suspect what the Chinese would like to achieve through all of this salami slicing is a regional acceptance of how China defines its borders, accepting permanent subordinate status. So when the Chinese talk about joint development in the South China Sea, I think they're sincere, but it's joint development along, say, a 60-40, 70-30 split. And China's not taking the 30 or the 40. and now, what does this mean for the United States? It means that, you know, in an ideal world for the Chinese, the United States is free to trade with the region. It's free to sail ships into the region, Navy ships into the region. But those ships better turn their radars off and should probably file a cruise plan before entering, the same for military aircraft. Freedom of navigation, as the Chinese keep reiterating, doesn't apply to what they define as territorial waters. And the South China Sea, as we see in this latest map, is territorial waters to their mind.
So before we jump into a little bit of the South China Sea part, you mentioned tributary states, and the first thing I thought of was the scene in the movie Sparta, where they come in and say, oh, but you need give just a little handful of dirt, and will China have a Sparta problem? Will the Chinese ambassador go to, I don't know, Vietnam or the Philippines, and someone screams the name of their country and kicks them into a pit. Not literally, but maybe, who knows? Maybe things will get really bad.
I have to admit, that's a very intriguing image. But Vietnam is a good example of someplace that might well try and do something like that. Here's the thing, and this is a fundamental part of our problem. In Europe, you had balancing of powers. If you think about it, Europe is comprised of multiple major powers, and they kept aligning and realigning and reshuffling the deck every time somebody tries to take over the place. Napoleonic France, Imperial Germany, Nazi Germany, Soviet Union, you always had balancing. In Asia, you had bandwagoning. All the neighboring countries, none of them actually ever fully said, this is Sparta, and kicks the Chinese ambassador into the pit. The closest would be Vietnam. And in fact, it's interesting that two of their folk heroes are these twin sisters who waged a like decade-long guerrilla war against the Chinese in 40 AD. So those rivers run deep. And of course, you have Japan. That's part of the reason why Japan is its own special little category for the Chinese. You might be able to reach some kind of compromise in détente with Malaysia or even Vietnam. Japan is a much different characteristic. So if any of these countries did do that, it will come as a great shock to the Chinese, because through thousands of years of history, you just haven't had that kind of reaction.
So to focus on the South China Sea, since we've been talking about the map, we've talked about salami slicing. People have heard about the maritime, their coast guard smashing different civilian vessels and some investigative or enforcement vessels from Vietnam and other countries. How integrated is this process with the PLAN and the PLA? Is the coast guard – how close – is the coast guard just another wing of the Navy with some stripes painted on them? Or how does that relationship exist?
That's a great question, and I wish I had a great answer for you. The problem is that so much of the Chinese system is opaque. I think that on any individual instance, especially when it wasn't a high priority, you might have had local authorities exercising all sorts of control. In fact, one of the things that's happened in the last few years is that the Chinese have streamlined their maritime law enforcement agencies. There were used to be something like 6 or 9 of them into about 3 of them. And one of them is in charge of all of the Coast Guard type activities. Now, the thing is that at this point, with the deployment of China's first deep sea oil rig, which is a multi-billion-dollar investment, and very high-level attention being paid to it, I don't think we should be assuming that this is some kind of uncoordinated action. That's the first point. Second point is, the reality is that, especially with these recent incidents, the PLA Navy has been present. It's just been over the horizon. The Chinese have been very careful not to have the Navy play the lead role, because they do recognize that's escalatory. But the Navy's there in case anyone decides to whip out, you know, larger armaments and start playing around. Now, this gets even more muddied because the Chinese maritime law enforcement folks have been the recipients of a cascade. As China has been commissioning new combat frigates, really nasty little things with SAMs and, anti-ship missiles, they've been taking their older frigates and repainting them white. So going from gray hull to white hull. So you've got some pretty well-armed Coast Guard cutters, essentially, out, because they are – imagine if we took Oliver Hazard Perry's Fig 7s and converted them into Coast Guard cutters. That's essentially what the Chinese –
Well, I don't know. Considering what our Figs look like now, it might be just the same thing, different day.
Actually, that's true. I think the older frigates may actually be better armed than an FFG-7. So imagine if we had kept the Spruances around and recommissioned those.
Yeah, absolutely. What kind of resistance will China see in the South? We've kind of already we've tangentially talked about it with that Sparta moment, but is this, and it sounds rather dour, but is this just a dance the countries will play because there's no way for them to stop China? I mean, they're building islands. There's nothing – you can't really stop a guy if you're Vietnam from building an airbase if his military is exponentially larger than yours. I mean, what is this going to look like as this escalates? Is it just going to be smaller and smaller, weaker actions of resistance, or will this meet a tipping point?
Well, there's a couple of answers to this. The first set of responses is what we're already seeing from the local states. Some are going the diplomatic route. The Philippines has taken China to court. Interestingly, both China and the Philippines are signatories to the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea. And the Chinese have made it very clear that they don't give a hoot under UNCLOS. Yeah, you're supposed to arbitrate. Well, I'll tell you how we're going to arbitrate. We're going to arbitrate by you accepting what I tell you to. The Filipinos, not surprisingly, say that's not how arbitration works under UNCLOS. China said, that's nice. We're not even going to show up. So that's one approach. The Vietnamese and the Chinese, of course, have been engaged in mutual ramming incidents. We know that the Chinese have sunk Vietnamese fishing boats. It's not clear if the reverse has been true. The problem here is twofold. One, this isn't, 800 AD. There are newspapers, there's Twitter, there's social media. The rioting we saw in Vietnam against Chinese-owned businesses, ironically, they went after Taiwan-owned businesses. I guess they weren't paying too much attention to which China they were protesting at, means that it's going to be a lot harder for local governments to step away, to back down. And second of all, it's not clear that they're going to. Again, in 800 AD, if the Chinese wanted to, they could just invade and nobody was really around to help a Vietnam or a Korea. But in the 21st century, the world in some ways has gotten bigger or smaller, depending on your perspective. The United States is a major player. Vietnam can invite the United States back to Tan Son Nhut, back to Cam Ranh Bay, back to Da Nang. And in fact, that's part of where we're heading right now. And that's a very different world than thousands of years of Chinese history has prepped China's leadership for. So really, it does come back down then, to answer your question, to the United States. What are we going to do about it? Are we going to stand by and allow the Chinese to salami tactic the South China Seas? Will we have the capability to really credibly try and deter China? And what are we going to do with regards to countries like Vietnam and Malaysia, who aren't treaty allies? And I would just note here, every time this administration says, we are not going to intervene in Ukraine because they're not a treaty ally, the Chinese do a global search and replace on Ukraine and put Vietnam in. So, it's not too surprising if the Chinese think, well, we may well have a free hand for now with Vietnam.
So what does that say about China's conduct within? So you've got UNCLOS. We've just signed the conduct for unplanned encounters at sea with them. So that's a new effort, kind of like the U.S.-Soviet incidents at sea agreement, except it involves a hell of a lot more countries. Is this, and this is the eternal argument with people who study international law, is this just them forcing us into a corner? Are we – Is the U.S.'s response by trying to shape China's actions with these systems of laws, with these agreements, are we just shaping ourselves for them, essentially? Or do you think that this is in some ways effective? It won't stop them, but at least it puts some kind of brakes on their operations.
My question to you is, what is the break? What is it that would make the Chinese behave? They signed the treaty. They had no sooner signed Q's than they immediately came out and said, by the way, this does not apply in Chinese territorial waters. And unspoken is as they define those territorial waters. So the South China Sea, this doesn't apply. I'm willing to accept that the Chinese will probably behave fairly decently in shipping lanes in the Bay of Bengal or off the Gulf of Aden or, in the waters around Guam. But, the Chinese have made it very clear, and their most recent pronouncements only support this. that when it comes to operating in what they consider their waters, their laws are going to apply. You know, the Chinese have said in almost as many words, if you want to have safe conduct, it's very simple. Don't come here.
Well, so. Yeah, that is a good point to take a quick break. We will be right back. We'll talk a little bit about the United States as well as China's neighbor, India. You know, we always think this is a China-U.S. deal, but there's a few, you know, there's a few billion people next door as well that we'll talk about right after this break.
Great content from the Center for International Maritime Security. Like the Sea Control podcast? It's at your fingertips. Go to www.cimsec.org. Don't forget to sign up at www.cimsec.org/about/membership to get our articles and announcements by email. And hey, if you feel inspired, feel free to write us an article or two, or five. Make sure to check out our partners. Our friends at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute produce the Sea Control Asia Pacific Edition. Our friends at the Phoenix Think Tank produce Sea Control East Atlantic. This and other fine forums can be found on our homepage. Join the discussion.
And we're back talking about China with Dean Chang. Dean, we left off. We were about to enter into that big question of what does the United States do? So we've talked about the agreements we've tried to set up. We've talked about UNCLOS. We've talked about this kind of idea that international laws and institutions will constrain people. And you've made it very clear that the institutions, it sounds like, constrain no one but the people who respect them, which happen to be us. So, what's the United States to do?
Well, several things. One thing is to keep in mind that it's not simply a matter of institutions matter only to those who care about the institutions, but that in an almost internationalized version of Saul Alinsky's rules for radicals, the Chinese have been seriously thinking about things like legal warfare. When we sign on to treaties, when we sign on to agreements, we need to recognize that far from a rule of law, whereby the rules apply to everyone equally, the Chinese believe in rule by law, or rule through law, the application of rules, laws, norms to try and constrain others and to maximize their own benefits. And the Chinese have actually written, you know, what is the point of legal warfare? The point of legal warfare is to show that what I do is legal, what you do is illegal, and if I break the laws, it's because you forced me to. Yeah, this is a very different point of view than the idea of all of us are equal before blind justice. So that's one aspect. Another one is the importance of recognizing that, one, we should not draw red lines lightly. And in fact, red lines are often very, very dangerous things to draw at all. But if we are going to go to the trouble of drawing them, then we darn well better be prepared to enforce them. Because all that salami slicing and all of that is part of the Chinese effort at shaping the region. It's not just, you know, bilateral China, Philippines, China, Vietnam. This is talking about creating, in a sense, a new regional order. And in fact, Xi Jinping recently gave a speech where he said the problem in Asia is the current alliance structure. And we need to get rid of, you know, by we, he's saying, you know, not me, Dean, but him, she. China wants to see Asia get rid of its current alliance structure and reorganize in a new way that very clearly would move China to center stage. So the Chinese are more and more openly challenging the American-led status quo. A third part to this is to get our own economic house in order. I mean, now we are finding out that first quarter of this year, the economy shrank by perhaps 3%, 2.5%. I mean, folks, this keeps up. We are talking not just a recession. We are talking, you know, deep recession, pushing towards the D word here. That's going to affect the amount of money we have available to do things like build defense. And the Chinese have made very clear that they are not, you know, this is sort of like Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon versus the Soviets, right? We build, they build, We stop building, they keep building. And, you know, what we have seen is a Chinese military that has distinctly modernized, and not just in equipment. Equipment's the easy part. They have been modernizing their doctrine and their training. So if it comes down to a conflict, they are going to, they're not going to just take all their new toys and use them, you know, in old-fashioned ways. They've been very careful students of how we fight our wars and have been building a military designed partly to do what we can do, but as much also designed to prevent us from doing what we want to do. That's a very different challenge than Iraq, Serbia, Afghanistan, or any of the other people we've had to go, you know, up against since the end of the Cold War.
So you've come up right along the edge of talking about A2AD, so anti-access area denial, the idea being America's Navy is designed for sea control. We go out, we kind of sit off somebody's coast, and we do whatever the heck it is that we want because we own the space. We own the commons. And there are two different answers to this right now. And rather than talk about the merits of these two methods, I want to use them as a way of understanding the Chinese. What do the Chinese think are escalatory? How do they view this conflict? So let's say the balloon goes up. TX Hams has offshore control. His idea is to try to block off trade to China through major straits and using, you know, insurance and stuff like that because it's an active war zone, so companies will naturally not send ships up there, et cetera, but cut off the lifeblood of China. And the second plan is air-sea battle. So it's this integrated concept of taking the Air Force and the Navy and networking everything together and gaining this thing that the Navy's calling all domain access. So we're punching holes and we're going wherever the heck it is that we want. And some people say that this would involve a more conventional conflict against the Chinese Navy up front and personal within the second and first island chain. Which one do you think would be more escalatory? Because that's the argument a lot of people are making. They're saying, hey, conventional strikes on shore radar stations would be more escalatory than shutting down the economy. And then other people say, hey, wait a minute, this is about the mandate of heaven. They're looking to ensure their rule. Is it actually more escalatory to do a system attack on their economy by this offshore control? Just use these as a model to discuss writ large what China sees as most escalatory and how you think they would react to these two different types of conflict.
Well, you've opened up a big can of worms. So I'm going to take a few minutes here to try to address this very large, you know, class 10 size can here. To begin with, I think anti-access area denial is not so much about sea power per se. It's actually about air power. The Chinese economic center of gravity, I know that's dangerous thing to use today.
Lawrence Friedman says it's not allowed anymore.
Yeah, well, okay. Far be it for me to challenge Lawrence Friedman, but I'm going to use it anyway. The Chinese economic core, okay, has moved from inland China, where it was in the 1960s, it was deliberately placed there to be out of the way, hard to access, to the coast. It moved there beginning under Deng Xiaoping because, like John Dillinger said, that's where the money is. If China was going to be an export economy, it needed to be close to the sea lanes, to ports, to get raw materials and to ship exports out. So from basically Tianjin up in the north all the way to Guangzhou, that is a huge mass of factories, railroads, highways, etc. China has to defend that. How do you defend that? You need to buy depth. And that is part of the whole point of what we call anti-access area denial, and they call counter-intervention. It is basically trying to keep air power writ large, whether it's carrier-based air power, land-based air power from Guam or Okinawa, air-launched cruise missiles, sub-launched cruise missiles, ship-launched cruise missiles, from being able to just easily come in and target China's economy and, as well, its military facilities, communications infrastructure, energy infrastructure, all of those sorts of things. So with that in mind, frankly, I don't see either offshore control or air-sea battle as addressing the real issues, in part because nobody ever seems to be able to tell me, and then what? So we engage in either of these strategies, and the Chinese will respond in one way or another. Define for me how we think victory is supposed to happen. Is it that the Chinese sort of say, oh my gosh, you bombed, fill in the blank, onshore, offshore, sank a ship, did whatever. I'm sorry, I didn't realize you were serious. Can we just sit down and get back to selling you bobbleheads and taking dollars and T-bills? No. If the Chinese are going to go to war, we're talking about something kind of serious here, in which case they're probably going to be prepared to accept a lot of damage, because whatever it is they are going to war over, they think is important enough to go to war over. Okay, so very quickly, T.X. Hams' proposal. On the one hand, I think T.X. has a very interesting idea, because he is going after what might be a Chinese Achilles heel. But I've said this to T.X. before, and you may have seen some of my emails on this, which is, how much energy does China actually need in wartime? Because let's be honest, I don't think, yeah, if you're Walmart, forget about any more bobblehead dolls, towels, washing machines coming from China, right? And the Chinese aren't stupid. They know that too. So exactly how much energy does China need if it's not making consumer products for global export? And if you have a fairly authoritarian government that can clamp down on everything from private car use to factories being open. Now, the argument is, well, you know, the Chinese economy will then suffer. Well, actually, they're going to be churning out tanks and new missiles and more missiles and dimension missiles. And missiles. It's not exactly like, oh, you know what? We have nothing for you guys to do, right? So that's one piece to this. Another piece to this is, you know, TX kind of assumes that the rest of the world is going to line up with us. Europe is going to turn off the spigot. Russia's going to turn off the spigot. Everybody's going to turn off the spigot, and poor China is going to be isolated and blockaded and all alone. Well, let's see. What happens if the Chinese wait till they're the number one economy in the world? That's not waiting all that long. We're talking maybe 3 or 5 years here. And then this conflict begins. Are we so sure that when they are the number one economy in the world, everybody else is going to listen to Uncle Sam? In case nobody's noticed, we've kind of alienated a few people along the way. There may well be a few countries that simply want us to get our comeuppance. And that's before we get to the broader issue of, what's in it for Europe to cut off its relations with China? See, this sort of goes to the bigger question of, who do you think's going to win? Number one economy or number two economy? Most populous country or a really populous country? Asia is going to be looking at this, and they're going to know that however this war ends, they can't move 1 millimeter farther away from China. So, you know, again, this goes to the, if you think the world operates on European lines, yeah, but everyone's going to balance against China. If you operate on Asian lines, maybe a whole lot of these countries are going to try and cut their own deal, in which case, again, are you so sure that they're going to cooperate with us? Now, to air-sea battle. The problem there is, this is a war of tactics. Air-sea battle, what are we going to do? We will sink the Chinese Navy. Maybe. Could get pretty costly. Because that Chinese Navy doesn't have to go away from China's shores. It can operate under a massive missile and air umbrella. And last time I checked, DF-21s, at least in theory, outrange F-35s. So how are we going to get at these guys? Now, we just announced a purchase of 10 more Virginia-class subs. We are, you know, serious, you know, kick booty time with boats. Hopefully. But again, we're going to be operating in their environment. The Chinese may well have a better idea of what the underwater terrain looks like, and they may well have modified it, aka mines. And every time you kill something, you're leaving behind a flaming datum. So an interesting, scary question here is, how many shots do you think a Virginia class gets before you get swarmed? Oh, and let me just note here, we invited the Chinese to RIMPAC. The Chinese showed up at RIMPAC. One of the things we practice at RIMPAC is submarine tactics. I'm sure the Chinese are going to be very polite and not take any notes on how our submarines operate.
Well, we'll do it wrong. We'll do it wrong this time.
Oh, we'll do it wrong. Right. Okay.
They're now, like, wow, just, they don't know what they're doing. And we'll be like, guys, keep playing.
Yeah, that's a
like...
good deterrent. no, but along a serious note here, though, think about this, right? RIMPAC is unique in part because for a lot of subcommanders, this is their one time in their lifetime. They will fire a warshot, right? Maybe not so much for us, but definitely for our Australian and Japanese allies. If you think the Chinese aren't taking notes on how those boys operate and girls, you know, then you're definitely underestimating them. So we're kind of showing them our whole card here. How we do anti-submarine warfare, how we do, you know, submarine warfare. And I continue to ask the question, what exactly are we getting out of this? Because I, you know, there's a lot of folks who say, oh, but this will improve relations. Why? You know, if you give me something for free and I don't respond by giving you something, I'm not the one at fault. So.
No, it's a very fair point. Now, since we're on the topic of war, something that you mentioned that I want to circle back around to a little bit, you mentioned lawfare. And the first time I'd ever read the term was in Unrestricted Warfare. And that's a book by two Air Force, Chinese Air Force colonel. One is a poet or something, which is weird, but I guess there's a lot of those in China. So my question is this then. On a weird turn on this question, what does China consider war? Do they consider themselves in a type of war now? And what would they consider if done to them an act of war?
Man, you've got a line on big cans of worms. So
it's what we do.
Okay. First off, on unrestricted warfare, let me just note the following. That book was written by two PLA Air Force colonels. It was published through the PLA Literary Publishing House. It should not be considered authoritative. It does not reflect Chinese doctrine. It does not, you know, it is not necessary how the Chinese themselves think they will operate. That being said, one of the two, because they were colonels of literature, yeah, the PLA does have these sorts of things. Interestingly, however, the other one is now the president of Beihang University, Beijing University of Aeronautics and Astronautics. So an interesting thought right there, which goes to the heart of also what was an unrestricted warfare, which is attack the enemy in ways you don't expect. And that may not be doctrine, but that is part of how the Chinese think about going to war. How do the Chinese think about going to war? I would suggest that in the grossest oversimplified terms, if Clausewitz was politics, war is politics by other means, then the Chinese attitude is politics is war by other means. So there is legal warfare. There is public opinion warfare. There is psychological warfare. Psychological warfare is not simply leaflets and broadcasts and, you know, compass call and commando solos jamming TV signals off the air. It is trying to shape perceptions. It is building alliances, united front tactics. It is having the head of Costco, the Chinese Overseas Shipping Corporation, barnstorm the United States, talk about how many jobs China has created in former dilapidated ports, building container facilities, warehouses, etc. It is economic pressure, such as the Chinese have done to the Philippines and done to Taiwan when they were unhappy. The Chinese let millions of dollars worth of bananas rot on the docks on the grounds of, look, you know, if you don't want to rot, you shouldn't be taking us to court. And in an uglier example, after the big hurricane hit the Philippines, the Chinese deliberately kept their hospital ship in Pakistan. The message was very clear. Good behavior, like Pakistan, will be rewarded. Bad behavior, like the Philippines, will be punished. So I think that the Chinese are engaged, whether we want to call it war or not, I personally preserve the concept of war to the use of violence. But that's me. I would say the Chinese have no question in their mind that they are engaged in a long-term fundamental strategic competition with the United States. That this is not for, you know, minor advantage. This is for dominance into the 21st century. This is China wanting to make sure that it will not be intimidated. Again, the word for deterrence in Chinese is the same word for coercion. They want to be able to deter, but also to coerce. The Chinese term is wei shi. And that doesn't necessarily mean that they want to take out the United States militarily or even in other ways, but they most certainly are concerned about their neighbors, like Japan. Now, unfortunately for U.S.-China relations, most of those neighbors happen to be allies of the United States. So from the Chinese perspective, at the end of the day, the main strategic direction, the main opponent, comes down to us. Because as General Feng Fenghui said during his recent visit, he is the head of the General Staff Department, essentially the chairman, the head of the Army Chief of Staff, coupled with some other roles equivalent. Your pivot is what is allowing Vietnam and the Philippines and these other countries to challenge us on our territory. So from their point of view, we are the problem.
So to extend this question then, what would China see then as an act of war? So what's there, and you said red lines are dangerous, but I'm using this as a sloppy term, is what's their red line? What gets crossed? Where are the arenas in which if we start throwing rounds across the deck, got it. But where are some of the more questionable areas in which there's a little bit more potential for the Schlieffen plan to engage, if you know what I mean? Like, hey, I've mobilized my troops and I've unwittingly sent the Germans to war, same thing with China. What?
Well, this goes to a real fundamental difference between us and the Chinese. Our, right or wrong, some of the lessons we've drawn from World War I, which is coming up on the 100th anniversary of the start, and as important, the Cuban Missile Crisis, has been that crises develop momenta of its own. You try and control it, there's no guarantee you will. The Chinese have a very different attitude. The Chinese are a lot more like the old Outer Limits show. We control the horizontal, we control the vertical, we control the volume. And so they seem to feel that crises are something that can be manipulated because it won't get out of hand. That's one part. Another part of this is that the Chinese basically are operating at telex speed in a Twitter universe. They are a consensus-oriented decision-making process. Their decision-making process, as far as we can tell, is fairly slow, doesn't always keep up. Now, that's okay from their perspective, because after all, they're going to control the pace of the crisis. So what could cause things to start spinning out of control? Imagine if the Vietnamese sank one or more Chinese fishing boats. One of the interesting problems, I think, is going to be that the Chinese seem to feel that they have a right to sink Vietnamese fishing boats, which are, after all, from the Chinese perspective, operating in Chinese waters. But the Vietnamese have no right to sink a Chinese fishing boat. Obviously, the Vietnamese may well disagree. Two, what if, because lately the Chinese have been buzzing Japanese aircraft in the East China Sea air defense identification zone, what if a Japanese and Chinese plane collide? At that point, you're going to have a whole lot of public opinion in both countries that is not going to be willing to back down. And for all that China is an authoritarian government, they have to keep an eye towards the population. And you can cut deals, like I said, with Southeast Asian countries. Maybe. We're not sure about that. Cutting a deal with the Japanese is the sort of thing that is going to just put people out in the streets in massive protests. Now, the Chinese have no one to blame but themselves. They have stoked that nationalist tiger, especially about Japan, for the last umpty-ump years. But now they could find themselves in that situation. Third, the USS Cowpens nearly collided with a Chinese amphib just a few months ago in the South China Sea. Imagine if the Chinese had been pushing it a little closer and something bad happened. Think about the EP3 incident from back in 2001, except at sea. Imagine there's a loss of lives. And those are Navy ships. Now what happens? I don't necessarily think that you're going to have a shooting incident over that, but you're going to see both sides immediately take this as an escalation, and you're going to start seeing a much more serious reaction than just commentary and exchanges. Now, transfer that to the south, to the East China Sea, around the Senkakus. And now you have all the ingredients for things getting way out of control. Now, that's all along the China, you know, along the Chinese littoral. The other possibility is that you could have an incident between China and India. Now, earlier this year, the Chinese sent a company of troops across into India, 20 kilometers in. They pitched tents. Some people, Western analysts, not the Chinese, I'll note, said, oh, maybe they got lost. Well, they were also getting resupplied. So evidently the Chinese were so bad at land nav that not only did those guys get lost, but the resupply guys went, you know, flying helicopters in and all that.
Mistakes happen.
Mistakes happen. Well, and then a couple months later, the Chinese went back across again. So they stayed there for a couple of weeks. They went back. A few months later, they came back, this time carrying large banners that said, this is Chinese territory. I again, maybe it was all a mistake.
But I think the subtleties are lost.
Yeah. Lost in translation, probably. But now you're talking about messing around with a nuclear-armed power in disputed territory. I mean, throughout the Cold War, you never had West German troops march into East Germany for 20 kilometers and say, this is, you know, West Germany, and vice versa, right? You never had a Soviet tank company just wander across the Fulda Gap and say, oh, I'm sorry. But the Chinese seem to have no problem doing that. That should be we should take this very seriously, that they don't think about crises and crisis avoidance the same way we do.
So, and we have a lot of new Indian members, so this is a good question to bring out for them. Rather than, and again, because I want to bring this around to the Chinese perspective, what is the Chinese perspective on India? How does China see India? Independent of what you and I know about India, what we know about Indian policy, what's China's take on India?
Up until recently, I think the Chinese, frankly, didn't take the Indians very seriously. I think that lately the Chinese are starting to take the Indians more seriously for a couple of reasons. One, India, frankly, has more friends than China does. China's only friends are pretty much Pakistan and North Korea. Not exactly a great lineup. India, just look at their weapons purchases. C-17s from the United States, a very used aircraft carrier from the Russians, the Rafale fighter from Europe. India has access to a lot more of the global military market. Second of all, in about 10 years, because of the two countries' very different demographies and population policies, China is going to have fewer people than India, and China will definitely be older than India, which basically means that if you're on the Chinese general staff, you have to actually think about the possibility of fighting outnumbered. When do you think the last time it was that any Chinese general ever had to worry about being outnumbered? Now, India is not going to send its army all the way through the Himalayas. That's not the point. The point is, that's a very, you know, quantity does have a quality all its own, and the Chinese do respect that. The third piece to this is the question about whether or not India, because of its physical location, could hold at risk China's energy and other lifelines. And that's something that is of concern. It's one of the reasons I think why the Chinese do maintain a close relationship with Pakistan is to complicate Indian defense planning. And the other thing to keep in mind here is that India is a sign of Russian duplicity. Russia sells variants of the Su-27, Su-30 aircraft to both China and to India. It is pretty broadly recognized by aerospace experts that the Su-30 MKK, the Chinese version, is not as sophisticated, is not as good, frankly, as the Su-30 MKI, which is sold by the Russians to India. Part of this being that the Indians don't steal and repackage technology the way the Chinese do, including military aircraft. But part of this is because, frankly, Russia has a longer standing good defense relationship with India, which has often been tacitly about China. So all of this adds up to India by itself. I'm not sure the Chinese are all that concerned about India as reflecting this broader international environment, which from the Chinese view isn't necessarily all going China's way. That's the problem.
So two things that I just was thinking of is, one, is it really duplicity if you're openly selling weapons to everyone? I mean, it's kind of out there in the open. They're not really lying about it. Just to flesh this out a little bit, is that the extent, it sounds like, of Chinese policy towards India? It's to challenge them in these limited kind of low population areas that have historically been a challenge, just to let them know they're still there, and then hold them down on the other side with Pakistan. Is that really the extent of their India strategy, or does China, do you think, have a broader strategy to deal with the potential future challenge of an India?
Well, keep in mind, we're talking here about mostly military strategic issues. China and India are huge economic partners. I believe China is India's largest trading partner, and India is easily within the top 10 of China's. So while we are talking about navies and air forces and all that, businessmen on both sides are happily making lots of money off of each other. So that's one aspect. Another one is that China has been expanding its political footprint, but not necessarily its military one, throughout the Indian Ocean. This is a so-called string of pearls. It's been building ports, let me emphasize, commercial port facilities, and Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, Burma, Pakistan, the Seychelles, the Maldives, East Africa. So, but the Indians look at this as perhaps the first step towards China encircling India. India's response has been things like the Go East policy. So India and Vietnam have been forging relations. There's a very interesting and under-noticed India-Japan relationship that's been slowly building up over the last 5 or 6 years. So both sides are mostly in the political realm, a lot of economic relations that aren't antagonistic. But when it comes to the military, China has done a couple of things in addition to what we've just talked about. They have built up the Chengdu military region, which is fronts onto India. They have built a lot of infrastructure, railways, highways, air bases, army bases, all along the Qinghai Plateau and the Tibetan region, basically allowing them to be much more forward postured. There seem to be deployment of medium-range ballistic missiles and things as part of this. So it's more than just, you know, a little bit of you know, poking here and there. I've heard Indian military officers say that, you know, it's kind of to look across the border and you can see these bases within binocular range. You can, you know, when there are meetings about incidents on the border, Indian officers are driving up in these jeeps, you know, over jouncing horrible roads, and they show up covered in dust after a really nasty ride. And the Chinese ride up in limos because they've got paved roads all the way up to the border. That's going to have implications about logistics support and things in event of a conflict. But I don't think anyone's really expecting a Sino-Indian war anytime soon. I don't think either side seems to be wanting to head in that direction. But of course, as you've noted, there's a third player here, and that's Pakistan. If there were some kind of Indo-Pakistani conflict, what would China do? That's a really interesting question.
One final question on India before we close out. What are their thoughts on Narendra Modi? So the new prime minister, there's been talk, is he a China guy? Is he a Japan guy? A lot of people say that he could be Japan's best friend, and he's talking about building these new bridges with China. What's China's take on Narendra Modi?
I don't know. I suspect that the Chinese themselves are going to be trying to figure out where he stands. They will look at the history of BJP governments in terms of their past relations with China. They will look over, his economic performance, I believe, was pretty good. And they may assume that that means that he wants to cut economic deals with China. And like I said, China is India's, if not the largest trading partner, one of the top ones. On the other hand, as, being from the BJP, being, more than a little bit of a nationalist, he may well feel that I am not going to make any concessions, particularly on territory. I think one of the really interesting questions will be how Modi deals with the Tibet issue. Tibet, of course, is not particularly Hindu. But there are a lot of Tibetans in exile in India. The Dalai Lama, I believe maintains a residence in India. This is going to be an interesting issue because the Chinese have become ever more allergic to anything having to do with the Dalai Lama. So a really ugly crisis scenario would be what would happen if the Dalai Lama dies in the next couple of years? How will Modi deal with that? How will the Chinese deal with that? Well, actually, we have a pretty good idea of how the Chinese will deal with that. Chinese have already passed a law forbidding unauthorized reincarnation.
is there a form? Is there an actual form you can fill out before you're born?
I think actually there is. It's in vitro, but it's okay. You can do a touchpad kind of thing. The Chinese basically have made very clear that they are going to assert control over whoever claims to be the next Dalai Lama. The Dalai Lama himself, has said he will not reincarnate in China. So all of this is shaping up to be a really ugly set of power struggles within the Tibetan, government in exile, the Tibetan population on either side of the border, succession issues, all of which also touches on religious issues. And where will India come down on this? And of course, where will the United States come down on this? But the Chinese have already started moving pieces on the board to they've already established control over, the Panchen Lama, the number two guy. They did that 20 years ago, and they clearly are going to do that over the Dalai Lama.
So as a last question, to close out, the current strategy forum, if someone asked the CNO, okay, why don't you talk about China? And CNO said, don't unnecessarily antagonize China. This is a very, very specific perception that says, hey, I don't need to say anything negative. I don't want to stir the pot. And when we've seen what we've been doing, it's been a shaping policy. We're hoping that building a relationship changes the situation. But you've given a different view of this. You said they see crises as opportunity, things to potentially build. They will stir the pot either way. They're using this to their advantage. So how seriously should American political leadership take that issue of verbally antagonizing China? What would be the effect of a change in tone from American political leadership? What's real? What's not? How much are we being manipulated?
Well, one of the things to keep in mind is you can only be manipulated if you're willing to be manipulated. Unfortunately, our leadership appears to be willing to be manipulated. And that's been true for the last several administrations and for a whole lot of senior military leaders. I got a room full of folks at the Stratcom Deterrence Conference a couple of years ago to laugh because I said, gee, I guess we're dealing with Lord Voldemort. He who must not be named.
Yep.
But one of my favorite movies is the musical 1776, where there's this debate about whether or not they should use the word tyrant in the Declaration of Independence until John Hancock finally says, Thomas Jefferson says, look, the king is a tyrant, whether we call him so or not. We might as well. And finally, John Hancock says, the king shall remain a tyrant. The point here is, you know, the Chinese have no problem saying that we are the enemy. General Zhu Chenghu recently made a very off-color remark about how the U.S. suffers from ED. he was making a play on words between extended deterrence and erectile dysfunction. This is apparently it's perfectly okay for the Chinese now. You know, and then you wind up with this incredibly annoying, you know, arrogance and hubris on our part of, well, we're better than that. All right, fine. If that's where you're coming from, yes, we're better than that. But if the idea here is we shouldn't be antagonizing the Chinese, I don't think it's too much to assume that what if they are in the mood to antagonize us? So the bigger issue here is that, in a sense, we are allowing the Chinese to tell us, to mold us, to shape us on what is acceptable terminology, right? At some point, the Chinese are also going to say, look, we're kind of annoyed that you don't accept that the South China Sea is our territorial waters. If you want to have negotiations, confidence-building measures, if you want us to show up at RIMPAC, you're going to have to accept that this is our territory. Now, you can say, oh, but, you know, we won't do that. But I could see this kind of attitude saying, look, if we say it is, but we don't act like it is, what's the problem? The problem is that if we won't call the king a tyrant, that is an action. That is a choice. If we don't want to antagonize the Chinese have told us how not to antagonize them. Stop reconnaissance operations off their coast. Stop publishing the annual DOD report on China and stop selling arms to Taiwan. If we keep doing those three things, we are antagonizing the Chinese, period. In which case, we might as well go ahead and call a spade, a horse, and China a threat, especially because they have no compunction about doing that about us. Now, should we go around and stomp on Chinese toes and spit in their face and not talk to them at receptions? No, that is unnecessary antagonism. You know, should we have mil-mil contacts with China? Yes, actually we should. I'm not saying we should not talk to them, not interact with them, etc. On the other hand, do we need to actually roll out everything for them? Do we need to basically show them our cyber strategy while not even asking to see theirs? And by the way, when we did ask, they said, go piss up the road. Yeah. These are the sorts of things where, you know, oh, well, we don't want to antagonize them. Okay, now you don't seem to understand the difference between not antagonizing them and kowtowing to them.
Hmm. Acting like the tributary.
Yes. You know, what will offend China? Let me not do anything that will offend China. Apparently, as I said, they don't seem to have too many compunctions about going so far as calling our outgoing ambassador a banana, yellow on the outside, white on the inside. Apparently, that's perfectly okay. We're just going to take it. Okay.
Well, Dean, to prevent unnecessarily antagonizing you, I've taken this 30-minute interview and I've turned it into an hour successfully. So. That's a win for me, and my condolences to the 30 extra minutes that I have taken from you. But before we close out, is there anything that you'd like to plug? You do work at Heritage. Are there any blogs that you'd recommend? Do you have any works that you'd like people to go to? Twitter handle, any other podcasts you're on, et cetera, et cetera. Just open the floodgates. Dean Chang World, what's out there? What should we go see?
The one thing I would suggest to your readers, if they're interested in the subject, is that I did write a trilogy on Winning Without Fighting, about legal warfare, public opinion warfare, and psychological warfare, each of which is available at the Heritage website. I suggest those in part because they exploit a lot of Chinese language sources that honestly haven't been translated. So I think it does give you, your readers, your listeners, a little bit of insight perhaps into how the Chinese are thinking about what they term political warfare and the three warfares.
perfect. And again, I hope we can have you back. There's so many icebergs that we've been sailing around this entire podcast. We haven't even dug deep enough into some of this stuff. And really, your perspective is fantastic, and I can't thank you enough. For those of you that are interested and somehow haven't found these things, I mean, you're listening to a podcast, you must have. This is the Sea Control Podcast from the Center for International Maritime Security at www.cimsec.org. We are on Twitter at CIMSEC, and this podcast is available on iTunes and Stitcher Stream Radio, and I'm sure a whole bunch of other compilers of out there that take our feed, and I don't know understand how they work. Dean, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for coming out here, and really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. I look forward to coming back.
We hope you enjoyed the show. Remember to subscribe to us on iTunes or Stitcher Stream Radio. Leave a comment and a 5-star rating. However, the most important thing you can do for us is to tell all of your friends. We rely on you, the loyal listener, to get out the word and foster the discussion. Looking forward to seeing you next week. Oh, you thought I meant talking to you next week. Well, that too. But we can see you. Don't worry about it. Just remember to tell all of your friends.